When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to the Cobras and Fire podcast, part of the Decibel Geek Podcast Network, featuring special guest from Danzig, bassist Erie Vaughn.
Welcome to Cobras and Fire. My name is Baco, and I will not be joined by my lovable co-host, Luz Cannon, today. We have kind of something special in store for you. I had an opportunity to sit down and chat with Erie Vaughn of Misfits, Samhain, and the biggest part of his career was probably Danzig solo stuff, to talk about his career and, you know, give an insight on pretty much the bulk of Glenn Danzig's career, kind of a nice little peek into all that. The conversation ended up running almost 2 hours, so rather than try to piecemeal this together or drop it all at once, we're going to release this in two parts. So today's episode is part one. A couple days after recording this episode, it was announced that Erie would actually be a guest at the Rockin' Pod 2 in Nashville, Tennessee on August 25th. And if you know anything about this show, you know that we are going to be there too. Erie is going to do all the normal stuff, meeting fans, signing autographs, telling stories and that kind of stuff. But he's also going to do a Q&A moderated by yours truly. So that's something I'm looking forward to very much. So for all you Danzig, Misfits, Samhain fans, here's a chance to come out and meet somebody that was there for it. He's also got a brilliant book out called Misery Obscura that kind of gives you a behind the scenes look that nobody else has really offered on all three of those bands. You know, the Glenn Danzig early era Misfits, the Samhain stuff, which Erie was a member of, and then, of course, Danzig solo act. Erie and I get into all that and so much more during this very extensive interview. I hope you like it. It's definitely one for the super fan. And I hope to see you in Nashville. You should come out and meet Erie. I guarantee you, after listening to this, you're going to see he's a pretty approachable dude. So enjoy the interview. Welcome to the program, Erie Vaughn of, well, you were, you, it's hard to say. I mean, I knew you first from Danzig, but you have such, you know, I mean, you were in Samhain, you were very, you know, you had a front row seat to the Misfits, and how would you like to be introduced? What should I call, what should I say when I say, here's Erie Vaughn, you know him as what?
Everybody just says from Samhain, Danzig, and photographer, you know, for the Misfits, things like that, you know, nothing special.
Yeah, nothing special, man. Oh boy. Well, let's get right to the beginning there then. Now you did you take the very first photo session? I know you were real early on in the Misfits as far as taking pictures, right?
Nah, Glenn took all their pictures in the beginning when they started. like all their promo shots that you see, there are stuff on the records, you know, like the 45s. He went to photography school, or he took a course or something. I can't remember, but he knew some stuff. And, you know, he took a bunch of their pictures, you know, when they were like sort of studio setup stuff, and, you know, took individual pictures. But when they did band stuff, they usually had another photographer or Jerry and Doyle's brother, Kenny, to take pictures. But Glenn did almost all the stuff in the beginning that they used. And I didn't show up till around, well, Doyle and I went to middle school together. So we became friends in like 77, 78, and then went to high school. And I didn't really get into the Misfits until 79. You know, you told me about them, but one day he just came in with a couple of 45s and said, "Here's my brother's band. Why don't you check it out?" You know, and I'm like, "Oh, okay, cool." And then I liked that stuff. He gave me Our Business and I Live in Death. And maybe he came over and gave me the London Dungeon Three Hits from Hell record.
Still got it.
And I said, "Oh, that's cool. You got anything else?" You know, he says, "Well, I got all this unreleased stuff that I could put on a tape for you," but I didn't have a cassette player. All we had was an 8-track at the time. And so I gave him a blank 8-track cassette or tape, whatever you want to call it. And he burned me all the Static Age stuff and all the MSP sessions, which was, you know, later 12 Hits from Hell.
I was just going to ask you that. So you've heard the original 12 Hits from Hell?
Yeah, I still have it. That was all the stuff that was going to be recorded later for Walk Among Us and stuff. So I listened to that, and I used to put the tape in and put headphones on and practice drums to all their stuff, you know.
So you started out on drums before guitar or bass?
Yeah. Because I had taken drum lessons down at the boys club with a friend of mine who was in the Fife and Drum Corps. He was a real good drummer. And he said, "Well, you know," I expressed some interest. He says, "Well, why don't you come down?" And they were using those real big, giant marching sticks, you know.
Yeah. They're
like, you know, even bigger than the sticks that Chuck used to use. And, you know, get all the blisters and do all that stuff. And the teacher was a real taskmaster. And if you couldn't get it, he would just go, "Okay, next, you know, move on." And so I got the basics down. And then when I wanted to, you know, because Doyle said, "Why don't you keep practicing the drums, because we're eventually going to need another drummer," because, you know, drummers kind of came and went in the band. And so I started doing that. And I went up to this friend of mine. His name is Paul Gaiman, lived up the street from me. We knew each other from kindergarten. And I said, "Tell me the beat they're playing here." So he listened to it. And he goes, "This is it." And almost every song was the same beat. So I was like, okay, I got it. And then when I went down to try out for the band one time, Glenn came up to me and said, "Play me a beat." So I played him that beat, and he went, "Okay." And that was pretty much it. But
can you still play that beat?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Still, that's good.
I could still sit down and play, you know, keep time, you know. They didn't have a lot of fills, you know. They just had the basic, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 type fills, like Ramones, you know, that kind of stuff.
No, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, so I started taking pictures around middle school, 78, 77, and just kept doing it. And then when I got to high school, sort of became like, you know, one of the photographers. It's like, call you out of class and say you got to take pictures of the band, or, you know.
Oh, so when you say you started taking pictures around that time, you just meant like you had a camera and you got into it, not like that's kind of where I'm going. Like, how did you decide to the photography thing? How did you get drawn into it? Was it just like you had a camera that was cheap, or did you get some schooling, or?
No, my father got a camera when I was maybe 10 years old. My grandmother had gone to Japan and brought back a Nikon for my dad.
That was a big deal back then?
Oh, yeah. It's just still a, you know, great camera company.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I use them, too. But, like, you know, getting a Nikon meant going to Japan or something back then?
Well, she happened to be... She was a traveler, so she happened to be over there, and I guess wanted to bring him back a present. So she brought him back this really nice camera.
Okay.
And it's real big and heavy, and, you know, so he learned, and he knew this guy who had a photography shop, you know, sold supplies and all that. And he would go down and ask him, you know, about lenses, and he would buy, you know, like a long lens and maybe a, you know, a wide angle and a couple other things. And the guy taught him a little bit, and he practiced, and then he taught me. You know, like we were at this race because my dad was big into sports cars and stuff. And we went to this place in New Jersey called Lime Rock, where Paul Newman was actually racing that day. And so he handed me the camera and, you know, said, let's try to take some pictures. So, you know, I tried to shoot some stuff and took some pictures back, you know, in the pit area and things like that. And I had a friend who had his own dark room in middle school. And he was taking pictures, and he showed me a few things, taught me a little bit about printing, and then just became a thing that I would do all the time, because I took pictures as a little kid with my Instamatic camera, you know, setting up things and just taking, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And just became interested in that, and also it was an easy way to meet girls, you know, because you could say, hey, let me take your picture and stuff, and that's always a good icebreaker, and then I'll make you a copy, you know.
Yeah.
And set the other thing, and then I started shooting sports, you know, in high school. I shoot the football team, basketball team, baseball, whatever, you know, whatever had to be done, and then that stuff would wind up in the yearbook, and just kept doing that, and then I had art class and photography class from like freshman year on, and Doyle and I were in the same class a few times. And one day he just said, why don't you shoot the Misfits? Okay, and it was supposed to be on, like, I thought it was going to be next Sunday, and I was at the park playing basketball. It was actually, they thought it was going to be this Sunday, but I didn't know it was going to be this Sunday. I thought it was going to be next Sunday, so they showed up, and they're all made up and ready to go, and they're like, what are you doing? You were supposed to be taking pictures. I said, I thought it was next week. He goes, no, it's today. Come on. You know, so I had to run home on my bicycle and, you know, grab the cameras and, you know, hopefully I had film. I can't remember if I had film or not. But so we hopped into the Blazer or the Bronco, I think it was Blazer, and drove a couple hours up to this cave in either North Jersey or New York. I can't remember.
And these are the first shots in the early pages of Misery Obscura?
the cave stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And just spent the afternoon until it got dark, you know, taking pictures. And that was the beginning of the whole thing. And then, you know, I was like, oh, we got a show, you know, next week or 2 weeks from now. You want to come down and, or go along and shoot the show or whatever. So I did that. And I never shot a band live or pretty much any other band. I mean, I did that, made a few mistakes, got a few good pictures. And then like 2 weeks later, it was another show. It was in Philadelphia. They said, oh, you want to come along? And I was just like, sure. And so I shot that show and then just would give them the pictures or let Glenn see them. And, you know, and then just, I was making t-shirts at the time too, because that was another part of the art class. So they taught us how to make t-shirts. So I was making t-shirts, all the stuff that they were into, especially Glenn, you know, like monster stuff and, you know, cartoon things, you know, Underdog, Paul Winkle, you know, all stuff you couldn't buy back then. You know, it's not like today you can go to a store and pick up a Speed Racer shirt or a Batman shirt or something. We had to make them back then.
Did you make Glenn's Count Chocula t-shirt then?
No. He had this guy who made screens, you know, it was okay. A professional screen printing place. So he would just bring them down a piece of artwork or a comic thing and just say, make me a screen of this. I want it this size or whatever. So his screens were all like perfect, you know, so I had to, you know, actually do the screens on my own and, you know, expose them and then wash them out and then, you know, screen print them and stuff. Now he made that shirt, but I made like, you know, Quisp and, you know, Frankenberry and
sure.
A lot of superheroes and just anything that you wanted that you couldn't buy, you know. And then I would give him the Doyle, and then Glenn would see it and then say, tell her I want a couple of these. So I'd have to make him a couple, you know. So it was all that thing, and we just became more friendly and stuff, and, you know, it just kind of snowballed from there. And when they needed material for the inner sleeve for Walk Among Us, Glenn said, well, you know, give me all the pictures you got or whatever, and just printed them a bunch of stuff, and they used like about, you know, six of them on the sleeve and gave me credit, which was real nice, you know. So I thought that was a pretty big
anything
deal.
More did you get paid for it or
no?
Okay. I mean, it's a very different environment, you know. A couple things, you know, that just to bring people back to this time, you're dealing with film. In other words, you don't even get to see how good these things look like it is now, where you can blast off 10,000 pictures and pick three of them, you know. You really got to go develop them and find out if you had any gold. And it's a very, the punk part was very DIY. So when for the Walk Among Us thing, that was their major label record, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as you get the credit on the thing, does anything happen for you there? I mean, because to be honest, you had a really good eye for how to snap live bands, especially punk rock.
Well, by that time I had my own darkroom, so I could, you know, like after I did the cave shots, I knew I'd never sleep until I developed them. So I developed the roles, and before I went to bed, you know, I could see what I had gotten.
I like the way you said that, though. You were excited. You knew you had something. You wanted to see it, right?
Oh yeah. Well, I wanted to make sure I didn't screw up, you know. And and I was very happy with what I'd gotten, since I hadn't had any experience really, especially shooting those guys. They were all older than me, you know. And except for Doyle, he was a little younger than me. But I wanted to impress them and say, hey, you know, look at these great shots I got, stuff. So it was, I made contact sheets and I brought them over to their house, and Glenn saw them and picked this one, picked that one, whatever. So I had to make prints and you know, so, but yeah, I was very happy with that. But, no, I was used to shooting sports. Okay. So you have to learn what to focus on. And since I didn't have an auto drive, I had to take one shot and get one good shot.
Yeah.
That's the way it was, you know. So, like, if the action's coming to you, you got to go, okay, well, where are they coming to? Like, if it's a basketball, what do they want to do? They want to get to the rim. So you focus on the rim, and they run right into the frame, and they're already in focus, hopefully.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Because you don't have the time. You have to set up and say, okay, action's coming here. I got to be ready. and then take the picture. Same thing with football. It's like, okay, you're going to, I was on the sidelines. The coach would call for a play. I'd say, which way is this play running? They'd say, it's coming right towards you. So I'd focus, you know, 5-10 feet in front of me, and a guy would run right into the frame, and I'd take the picture, you know. So I did that with the Misfits, too, because they were very active, and, you know, you had to look at it as if it was a sporting event. So I knew Jerry would come to a certain spot because he moved around the most. And, you know, Glenn was always on the ground and in the crowd and getting beat up and stuff and, you know, freaking out. But Jerry always went up and back. So I knew he'd come to the microphone at some point. So I just focused on the microphone and then waited for him to come into the frame. And, you know, so, and just had to learn how they moved. And after a show or so, I was like, okay, I know what these guys are doing. And, you know, they weren't playing on these huge stages that you had to go chase them. They would come to you. So, you know, key in the crowd and try not to get killed.
That could be the other downside, though, is because with these smaller venues, you basically are fighting the people, correct?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've got some shots for me in the crowd where, you know, you try not to get kicked in the head and people are stage diving. And, you know, plus they were all slamming and stuff. And so it was, you were getting pushed around a lot. And so you had to focus and go, okay, if that's in focus, I'm not going to try to focus again because, you know, you're just going to get knocked around. So a lot of times you're just taking a chance. But wow. Like I said, I had to take one picture at a time and get one good one, you know, so I didn't have the luxury of taking 50 shots and picking the best one.
Yeah,
you know?
That was my
point.
So
that was kind of tough.
Yeah.
But see, then all that shit, there was little fanzines and things, and you would get to be friendly with other photographers and just guys in bands in the crowd and stuff like that. And everybody be like, well, I got this fanzine. I'm doing a story on the Misfits or whatever. You got any photos? And I'll be like, yeah. So you give them a couple of photos and, you know, just went on like that. And it was, yeah, it was all the stuff was like all the records were all laid out by hand. You know, you take the photo, you put it on a black background or whatever, and then you have to lay in your type and all this stuff. And it was basically like paste up, and then you take it to a printer. And they print off the sleeves, and then you cut them and glue them together, and you put the records in when you get them from the record print, pressing place. And, you know, everything was done by hand. So, you know, it was really cool. I really liked that and learned a lot that you could just go out and put out your own records and not, you know, not wait for somebody, some record company to give you a contract, you know, and then they take care of everything and they screw everything up, you know. So
yeah.
you had total hands-on control, which I thought was great, you know.
Was Glenn clearly the creative, like, person? Like, he had to green-light everything?
Well, in my opinion, Jerry was always coming up with ideas, too, but I don't think they always agreed on when it came to, like, artwork and stuff like that. So, yeah, I think Glenn was the one who's, so I would say, the art director, you know. But yeah, I think his opinion carried a lot of weight, and I'm sure him and Jerry had multiple arguments about certain things. Like if you know about the first Horror Business sleeve, the back cover is a totally different picture, and Jerry had gotten those printed up, as far as I know. And when he got, you know, 10,000 of them made like Jerry does, and brought them back and said, Glenn's like, here, I got the sleeves made, you know, all this stuff. And Glenn said, no, it doesn't look right because it wasn't black and white. It was kind of gray and white. So that's why those sleeves never got used, and they're still sitting in Glenn's basement somewhere like this.
And
they went back and did more of a graphic, just black background with heavy contrast white, just faces. And, you know, stuff like that. So, yeah, there was, I'm sure the two of them really, you know, you can see now, they're all these years later, they're still butting heads over things like that.
Yeah.
T-shirts and stuff. So, yeah, I think Glenn was the one who really steered the ship when it came to a lot of things. But Jerry had a lot to do with the look of the band, you know. And I think it was a good collaboration.
We'll be right back.
any of the pictures you ever took used as like a 45 single sleeve at all? Or
when Glenn had the we put out the Evil Live 45, the first 1,000 pressings were just for the theme club, just for the people who were members, and I guess they could, you know, order them through the mail like they did with the T-shirts, and I don't think he put them in the stores.
Okay.
And then when that sold out, he decided to do another pressing, and, you know, with a different label and things like that, and then he sold those in stores and to distributors and stuff. But he had, at the end of the two runs that they did, or the three runs, he had like 33 records left with no sleeves, you know. So you can't just go get 33 sleeves.
Yeah.
You have to get like at least 1,000. So what
back
did,
then, anyway.
He went to the copy shop and laid out different covers. So there was three different covers, and he put those in 11 sets of three. So
oh,
that was
boy.
33 records. So he used one of my photos for his one, because it was one of Jerry, one of Glenn, and one of Doyle. So he used one of my pictures from a club in Jersey City, the last show I shot them at, and that was pretty cool, you know.
Well, you were still in high school at this time. Did you actually go on the road at all?
Oh, no, I couldn't do that. You know, I mean, Doyle could take, a month off, which he did once when we were in seniors, I guess, to do a tour for Walk Among Us, I think it was. So that's when they went out to California.
He's a lot younger than the other two then.
Glenn's 9 years older than me.
Okay.
Jerry's 4 or 5 years
all
older
right.
than
okay.
me.
Okay, all right. I'm getting it.
Yeah. Yeah, so Doyle got permission, I guess, to be out of school for a month.
He got a pass to go on tour.
Yeah,
with
well, like, you know, I'm sure it didn't really hurt his grades any. But so I remember that. And no, I couldn't go on the road. I did a couple of local gigs, you know, here and there, stuff that was easy to get to, you know, some New York stuff, and like I said, the Philadelphia show and other. You know, a couple other things,
yeah.
You know, they would either give me a ride or I'd have to get down there myself. But
Walk Among Us was close to the end for them, right?
Well, they had, what did they do after that?
I want to say that was 83. I don't remember.
No, 82 was when that came
82?
Out.
82, okay. All
right. Right, so they right before that, they put out the Halloween record, and they put out the Three Hits from Hell. Then they put out Walk Among Us, I believe. And then Glenn had put out Who Killed Marilyn in that time, like in 81 or 80. And then they did Earth AD in 83 with Robo playing drums, and they recorded it out. I'm not sure if they recorded it in California or not, but they used Black Flag's engineer-producer spot.
Yeah.
And recorded that, and that came out in 83. And then I don't know if they toured that much with it. It's hard to remember. But they broke up not long after that,
you know.
So the record was probably only, you know, maybe 6 months old or something.
And that's kind of where you come in as a musician, if I'm following your career right. You were basically, he went from Glenn left the Misfits, started Samhain, and you were the bass player from the beginning, correct?
No, I started off as the drummer. I was doing my own band, and I had to put out my own records. And I was playing drums. We were doing
is that the, what were they called? I know
Rosemary's
it's in your book.
Babies.
Rosemary's Babies. I didn't know they put out a record.
Yeah. We put out a 10-song, 7-inch on red vinyl.
Is that on Spotify?
like 20 years later, we put out a CD with like the 10 songs plus 10
okay.
songs that we had in the can and plus 5 live songs. Put that out. That's around. You can find it on one of those things, or you can just go on YouTube and, you know, it's on there, you know.
And
that sounds real good, you know.
Erie, before we get too far, I would like to mention your book, Misery Obscura. For anybody listening, is the book still available? I'm not even sure. I bought it pretty much right away, but I've had it for obviously some time at this point. But it's almost a chronicle of Glenn Danzig's life in a way. I mean, it touches on more than that, but that is the big focus of the Misfits, Samhain, your time in Danzig, which is we'll get to that in a second. But that is the time of Danzig. And also your band Rosemary's Baby is covered in there, plus some of your shooting of football and all that good stuff. Is that still something that a listener could buy? Have you done more printings, or is it sold out?
No, we did the first two or three printings with Dark Horse, the comic company.
Okay.
And that's
it's
sold.
Beautiful, and, by the way. The one I got is nice hard copy. Got kind of a varnish on the front there to kind of offset some of the stuff. It's just nice.
Yeah, it came out real nice, and people loved it. And, you know, I just basically told the story about, you know, how things started for me, you know, and how everything went. And everybody in the book was just characters in the story, you know. So after 3 years, the contract was up, and I got all the rights back and all the, you know, material. So I went to another company. It's called Bazillion Points. And a guy named Ian, who puts out wonderful books of, you know, bands and just great stuff. So it's still in print now. We've done, you know, one printing. I'm not sure if we're ready to do a second one. But, yeah, it's still in print. You can get it. You just, you know, you can get it at Amazon. Yeah, it's good. It's everybody says they read it over and over again. You know, you sit down and it takes you about an hour to go through it, and then you read it again. And then you know.
Exactly what you're saying. I'm just, if anybody listening, just track it down. It's called Misery Obscura by Erie Vaughan. If you're a fan of that era of the Misfits punk, the New York punk scene, if you're a fan of the Samhain or Danzig, you're not going to find better firsthand photo photography and plus a great story. You fill it in with the your own anecdotes as all the way through. So check it out, people, please.
Yeah, it's easy to read because I wrote it as, like I'm talking to you now. You know, I wrote it just like if you're sitting here talking to me, you know, that's the way it goes. So you kind of
get
into it because it's easy to read, and then you see the pictures and the references, like, okay, I was talking about this, and then here's a picture of it, you know, or whatever, you know, or where it was, when it was, what was going on at the time. So yeah, it's good. I'm very happy with it, and we're working on a follow-up to it. So,
well, that's, you know, awesome too. Back to the founding. How did Samhain come together then? Did Glenn and Jerry split the Misfits camp into two? Did you kind of follow Glenn while Doyle followed his brother?
Well, we were out of high school by then, and usually, you know, unless you're real close with somebody, you know, after graduation, you never see these people again.
Right.
You know, so Glenn and I had become friends, you know, in the band, you know, with the band. And then when they broke up, you know, we had been talking a lot, and then it was basically, I would hang out with him and we'd go to movies or, you know, have lunch, talk about comic books and toys and, you know, stuff like that, monster movies. And it was, we basically were, you know, I was having a little trouble with some of the guys in my band, you know, not showing up for rehearsals or not being into it as much as they were. And maybe you wanted to go in this direction, they wanted to go some other direction, and, you know, you got to have a unified front. You know, you can't just say, well, you know, the songs have to sound, you know, be in the right direction, you know, the look of the band, everything, the attitude, all has to be, everybody has to be on the same page.
Absolutely.
So we talked about that, and he was evolving and wanted to do something a little bit different. His songwriting was becoming not better, but definitely better, but different stuff that wouldn't really work with the Misfits. And he probably does the same thing today. He always, he just writes, and he would write something and go, that's not right for the Misfits. Okay. I'll just put that on the shelf and use that later, or, you know, give it to somebody else down the road. So he had all these songs for his next band, like already kind of conceived in his head or written down. So he just says, well, he comes back from this, I think it was a Detroit show, it was the last show, and he says, well, you want to do the band or what? And I'm like, sure. And I had, you know, gear and drums, my parents' basement, so they were already set up for Rosemary's Baby. So I said, yeah, come on over, you know, on Tuesday or whatever. And so I had guitars and things, you know, so he just said, okay, this is the way this song goes. And first song we worked on was All Murder, All Guts, All Fun. Murder, all guts, all fun. Had this timing that wasn't, everybody's got this internal timing, and we used to say, oh, guys from New York have one timing, guys from Jersey have a little bit different timing. So it's like that if you go across the country, everybody's got their own little timing. It's just like an accent, you know, the way you talk. So all the timing was on, instead of ones and twos, or it was like threes and fives and, you know, like stuff that it wasn't naturally coming out because I wasn't a great drummer. I just, you know, played as fast as I could, you know. And so we went, did a rehearsal. Then I asked a guitar player from Rosemary's Babies to come down and maybe help flesh out the songs a little bit. We did that. Got to be two or three rehearsals. And, you know, we both came to the conclusion, but I certainly did that. I said, you know, I can't cut this. I'm not good enough drummer for this. For this stuff, you should get somebody else. And he goes, well, what about that guy Steve, who I went to high school with, lives in Lodi, can get the rehearsal. I said, he's a pretty good drummer. I said, yeah, he's a good drummer. He says, why don't you play bass? I said, okay. And that was it. You know.
So now you have settled the argument that bass is the easiest instrument to play, I think, correct?
Well, yeah, for punk rock.
Yeah, I'm messing around.
Well, yeah, but that's, you know, it's only got four strings, you know, I mean.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, it's not. There's some really great bass players. But,
I know. I'm having fun with it. I don't literally mean that.
No, I had to. I didn't know what the notes were. And Glenn would say, okay, this is an A. This is a G. This is a D. Okay. And then we just, you know, I had to cite everything. You know what I mean? Like, until I learned where the notes were anyway, you know, but. And yeah,
all murder, all guts, all fun, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's all a bad dream, you know. But, yeah, the first song that we worked on, me, Steve, and Glenn, at Steve's apartment in Lodi, was our version of Horror Business.
Oh.
You know, because it was very simple. We were going to call it Horror Biz. And, you know, so it was just like, it only had like five notes in the whole song, so, you know, we started with that, and just, you know, I just tried to muddle through and try to hit the right notes, and basically that was it. You just keep playing and try to get better, and, you know, just take it from there, just like any other punk band, you know.
So on the cover of Initium, how come there's only three of you?
We didn't have a guitar player at the time.
Okay.
And, yeah, so Glenn had done some rhythm tracks. And,
okay.
Yeah, he brought in Lyle from Minor Threat to do some more sophisticated guitar and maybe some lead parts. And that was the original concept of the band. It was going to be me and Glenn, and we would bring in guys when we wanted to make a record, bring in a drummer, bring in a guitar player. And then if those guys were available, when we went on the road, then they would go and they would play with us. If they weren't, we'd get other guys to go on the road. But it was basically going to be like a revolving door of musicians, you know, whenever we wanted to make a record. But you can't rehearse like that. So we had to say, well, that's a good idea, but it's not going to work because, you know, you got to work around everybody's schedule. And so we needed guys who were in town that could come to rehearsal a couple times a week. And we got Pete, who was playing with Steve in Morning Noise. And he lived in Rutherford, which was just, you know, 20 minutes away, 15 minutes away from Lodi. So he could get the rehearsal. He had his own vehicle and stuff like that. It's an old VW bus, you know. And so we had to do that. And then, you know, Glenn wanted to get the record out. We needed a cover, you know, so we took the picture. Record came out. After the first Rock Hotel show where Lyle played, we decided, well, we need somebody local, and then started rehearsing with Pete. And then went on tour, and the record wasn't out yet. So nobody knew who the fuck we were or hadn't heard any of the songs. Yeah. So we're playing like 20 people, you know, 30 people. But he wanted to go out. He wanted to get the ball rolling and, you know, let people know that, you know, this was a new band. It wasn't the Misfits and, you know, keep moving forward. You know, usually, you know, you got to have the records got to be out for a couple of months before you go on tour. But anyway, that's not the way we did it, you know. But next time we came around, everybody knew. So we were playing a couple hundred people by then, you know.
And so when you first started jamming, I assume it was all tracks that were kind of that ended up being on Initium. Is that fair? Because you mentioned two of them.
Yeah, he had already recorded a version of Archangel, like I don't know if it was while the Misfits were still together or right after that. I'm not sure. But that was a song he had written and he wanted to give to Dave Vanian from the Damned, you know, to sing. And I think it was either the Misfits were going to back him up and he was going to sing it and then put out a record. I don't know. I can't remember the story. I could be wrong. Or he was just going to give the song. Maybe he just wrote it for Dave Vanian because he thought it would go good with his style at the time. So we had that song in the can and he wasn't thrilled with the final version, so we re-recorded the bass parts and maybe some other guitar stuff. So we had the one track, and then went in, recorded, all the rest of the stuff. But that was the stuff that we were working on, as well as still playing a couple of Misfit songs to round out the set, because, like, our first show, we had, like, 9 songs. And, you know, that's not an hour. You know, so we had to throw in, you know, Die, Die, My Darling, London Dungeon or
okay.
You know, something like that. You know, a couple, just also as a sort of nod to the fans who were Misfit fans who came here to see what the hell this was all about. You know, so we, you know, if they didn't like the songs we were playing, because most of the Sam Hain songs were a lot slower, and they would be like, play faster. Glenn's like, you want to hear something fast? And they're like, yeah. It's like, here's another slow one. You know, and so, but then we do, you know, London Dungeon or Die Die or something like that. And,
okay.
You know, they would all get excited and, you know, might have played Death Comes Ripping every once in a while.
Well, Glenn has always seemed to have his eyes forward as far as what he was doing creatively, especially at this time of his life.
Well, you have to. You can't just keep playing the same old songs over and over again. You know, you have to keep moving and keep writing. And every song you hope to top the last song you thought was good, or the last record you put out,
sure.
You have to. The next record has to be better. You know, can't just go back and everybody liked that one, so we'll just give them another one of those. He's like, that's not the way to be. Some people do that, but that's not the way I look at it. And that's not the way he looks at it. I don't think. Well, at least he didn't then. So. I think any, you know, real musicians or people who are really creative, they want to beat, you know, what they just did, or they want to beat this artist that they really like. You know, the Beatles were trying to be better than Roy Orbison, and the Stones were trying to top Chuck Berry or whatever. It's just like, you just have to shoot for the stars, you know, or shoot for the moon and just try to get better, you know, every time, you know, that's just the way it goes.
Now, I know it was a long time ago, and you've played a ton of shows. But I know Sam Hain only played one show in my where I'm at, Minneapolis, but it was at the 7th Street Entry, part of the First Avenue Club. Any chance you have any recollection of that?
Oh, yeah.
Seriously?
Well, I'm a big Prince fan, so I was thrilled to be in the building where they filmed Purple Rain, you know?
Oh, right on.
Right, so it was snowing, and it was Minneapolis and stuff, and, you know, I know we were playing this little bar next to it, which I didn't even know existed.
Yeah, it's a little room off the side almost, yeah.
Yeah, but I didn't know that, you know? Yeah. So, after soundcheck or before soundcheck, I walk into the big room so I could see what it looked like, and it was so much smaller than it looked on the film, you know? And I was looking up at the balcony where they did these certain scenes and what the stage was like, and the stage wasn't very big, but it was bigger than stages we were playing, and just walking around the room and going, fuck, this is where Prince plays, you know? And he lives here and all this. It was very cool back then, you know? So we played that show, and, you know, it was great, like they usually all were. And then when we came through town, like in, you know, 1990, I think Danzig played the big room with Soundgarden, Corrosion of Conformity, and that was just fantastic. You know,
and
I was
Danzig
very
headlining,
about that.
Right?
Yeah, it was just it was great. I'm still a big Prince fan, and you know, always wanted to go to Paisley Park, and then he has to fucking up and die on me. So, you know.
Well, if you ever make it up here, I'll take you out to Paisley Park. It still exists.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm sure. Well, is it like Graceland now?
Pretty much, yeah. He's our Elvis, Erie.
Good. Well, then I look forward to that, yeah.
Yeah, they've turned it into, you can take tours and all this stuff. They basically, it is now defunct as a functioning entity, I believe. It is just about celebrating the life of Prince. So.
Well, that's great. Yeah, Jesus. I'm sure they're going to be putting out records of his for, you know, till we die.
Oh, are you kidding? You know? I mean, yeah. I mean, he lived longer than Hendrix and recorded more, so.
Oh, yeah, you know, like, recorded all the time. But the thing I liked about that was, I don't know if it was his club or somebody opened up the Glam Slam, wasn't there a club?
Yeah,
was,
yeah.
Was either, mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, like him, like, doing a show somewhere or anywhere around the country, and then after the show going out and going to some little club and then playing until the sun came up, you know, like the Allman Brothers used to do, yeah. That kind of shit, you know. And I was just like, this guy's a nut, you know, like he just loves playing so much that he could do 2 hours and then go play for another 3 hours or 4 hours. And, I just thought that was amazing.
Yeah, you're making me nostalgic and a little sad. I agree 100%. But back to Samhain. Samhain kind of leads into Danzig as a band. But John Christ, actually, he comes in during Samhain, correct?
Yeah, well, at the end, you know, we didn't have a drummer. We still had London. We didn't have a guitar player. So John came in, moved a town over, and started coming to, like, rehearsals. And we needed somebody to overdub guitar parts because Glenn and I were working on what was going to be the next Samhain record. So we had songs that wound up on the first Danzig album. And he wanted him to overdub a couple things on other songs. And, you know, so he played on that, the Samhain Grim, Sound Grim, The Final Descent. So that was going to come out. You know, we were going to continue the band like that, but things were changing, you know. It was just like it didn't seem like it was the right time for that to come out, or maybe it would never come out. Some, you know, you make records, sometimes they don't come out.
Okay.
But we got John after long auditions and stuff, and then, you know, Rick Rubin was involved by that time.
Well, that brings us to the end of part one. In part two, you probably figured, we get into the next part of Erie's career with Glenn Danzig, and that is the band Danzig and how all that came together, how they, you know, what it was like on their way up, and then, of course, the end and what Erie did after all that stuff. So I promise you, if you enjoyed this conversation and you're a fan of Glenn Danzig's solo stuff, you're going to love part two. Anyway, thanks for listening. Go to our Facebook page. Give us a rating. Go to iTunes. Give us a rating. We are now on Twitter. Please follow us on Twitter. Rock's not dead. It's hiding. Somewhere between the last Sam Hain record and Rick Rubin's butt crack.